The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Hello, everyone. Thank you one more time for joining my program, Afternoons with Mike. I am privileged to be on the line today with a guy that I've known getting 30 years now, Dan Walsh. Dan is a former pastor and a professional author. Now, it's not every day that I can talk to somebody that makes their living in doing something that I love, and that's reading. And Dan is able to do it in a par excellent way. Welcome back to my program, Dan.
Hey, Mike, great to be with you again.
You know, Dan, you are a longtime resident in the Daytona Beach area. Tell everybody a little bit about your background growing up in that area.
Well, I was born in Philadelphia people know my age, in 57. And we came down in 65 as kids. Basically, my dad, as along with a lot of other dads, came down when the Apollo space program was launched in the 60s. And this, the short version of the story is, when the Apollo program ended, we stayed. And so pretty much I have childhood memories of Philadelphia, and we've been back a few times to visit, you know, family. But really, I was more like born and raised in the Daytona area, where we've lived ever since.
Well, you know, that area is such a beautiful area. It's obviously most known as a tourist area for Daytona and all of the spring breakers for years going down there and being a part of that. But beyond that, when you get outside of the Daytona Beach proper and you go either to the north or the south to Ormond, and I know you have family that lives in Ormond, and to the south, Port Orange, and on down toward the Space Coast, when you are in that area, there's enough there that's just classic, gorgeous 1950s Florida. And it really is not anything like a tourist area like one would think of Daytona Beach.
Yeah, it's like we're actually, my wife and I grew up in Ormond. We always say Daytona Beach when we're speaking outside the city because everybody has heard of it. But you know, we actually grew up in Ormond, but when we got married, we moved to Port Orange in 1976, which is now like ancient. And we've actually lived all this time in Port Orange. We still do. So, you know, better than 40 years we've lived in Port Orange. But you're right. When we crossed the bridge, which is the last bridge in the Daytona area, when we cross the bridge to the beach side, you go left and you see what looks like, people are familiar with the Daytona, with the condos and the hotels and all. You go right all the way to the inlet, it's just like old Florida. There's no presence. So it's like it was 50 years ago. And you cross over New Smyrna, and you know, New Smyrna, you drive around there, New Smyrna reminds me of what Daytona was like when I was a kid.
And you've written about this in some of your books, and they are so interesting to read the stories, because you can tell, and this always, I believe, makes for compelling writing when the author has more than just a rudimentary knowledge of the area of which he's writing. When you write about it, it is part of your childhood. It is part of what you saw and what you experienced as a young man growing up in this area. That would have made you about age 7 when you moved down, right?
Right. I actually was in, second grade. So,
wow. That's tremendous. And tell us.
Here's a little interesting tidbit for people. When we moved down, of course, I wouldn't have known this fact then, but in the research for one of the books that you mentioned, I found out when, in that time frame, Florida was number 38 in the country in terms of population.
Mm-mm-mm.
And now I think we're third.
Yes,
and
yes.
I would say the largest part of that probably has to do with the development of central heat and air conditioning.
Yes.
Because that's really when air conditioning became cheap and widely available, Florida became a viable place. Prior to that, and anybody who's lived here like when the hurricanes take out the power, you know, which usually happens in summertime, you realize, yeah, there's no way people would live in Florida were it not for air conditioning.
There's no question about it. The first link, obviously, would have been the Flagler line when the railroad line ran all the way down. That was one of the early, connections that right. brought people from the north down to Florida. But then they would not have stayed. They would not have stayed. Maybe they would have been eternal snowbirds. But beyond that, you're right. In the summertime, if you don't have air conditioning down here, well, we can be flat out unbearable in our area. For those that are listening via podcast right now and thinking that Florida is paradise, it really is, unless your air conditioner goes out, which happened to me last year for a week. We had to wait a week for it to be repaired. And fortunately, a friend of mine was kind enough. They were out of town, and they opened up their home to us, and so we stayed in their home while our air conditioning was being repaired. That was a blessing, but that happens to us. Tell everyone a little bit about the book that we are referencing with your writing about early years and maybe some of those experiences. Tell us about that.
Well, I wrote... My first 12 novels were with a publisher, one of the largest Christian fiction publishers. I broke out on my own in 2015, and since then I've been writing novels, I guess like as an indie. But there are two novels really that I wrote that are seated in where I live. One is called The Discovery, which a large part of the story takes place in Daytona on the home front during World War II. But more specifically to my childhood, I wrote a novel called What Follows After that's also done very well, that's set during what people know as the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is October 1962. I was only five then and actually lived still in Philadelphia for a couple more years, but so much was the same between 62 and 65, so that when I wrote that novel, I was pretty much able to really go back to my childhood. And it was fun actually recreating. I went to the library and pulled out all these old newspapers from what was the Daytona News Journal for that era, and was just able to look at, you know, on this microfilm, just all the what was being said and thought. It brought me right back. I was like, it was just like my childhood seeing all of this stuff. So that story takes place, and it's a very good recreation if anybody's interested in what Florida was like back then, besides the story itself, which I didn't write it because of that, but as a sideline, it'd be really, really fun for me to be able to spend that time, you know, going down memory lane.
You know, you mentioned having all of that, that early bunch of books. I think you said 12 of them were written under a publisher that you had. And, you know, those were important times. I mean, you're one of these writers, Dan, that has made the transition. So you've lived in both eras, what I would call the old school era of authorship and publishing, where it was done for many, many years, pretty much the same way. But then comes along Amazon and the Kindle. And those two aspects right there kind of brought a massive shift in the way things are done. And you've been on both sides of that.
Yeah, when I got published, in my first novel was called The Unfinished Gift, came out in 2009. At that time, Amazon was available, but it's hard for people to realize, you only go back that, you know, a few years ago. Amazon was available, but hardly anyone used it. Kindle apps did not exist. The Kindle was like this little device that cost $300.
Yes.
And it was just for reading books in black and white and had no internet and there's no smartphones. So back then, I didn't know it, that I was coming into publishing at the tail end of almost a centuries long tradition of publishing, where the only way for authors to get books and, you know, people to read them was to be accepted by this very elite club of publishers, because if you didn't have a publisher take your book, there's no thought of quote going indie or self-publishing. That was like unheard of, because bookstores would only take books from mainline publishers.
It's the same way that music is only, it's published in a very niche kind of a way, and like what you described as being a very exclusive group, Most radio stations today that are playing even contemporary Christian music will not play any indie music. It's very difficult, not impossible, but very difficult for an indie artist to get their music distributed on air, on radio, because of the very same things. It's very focused, it's very funneled, it's very driven. There's a few lanes that are open inside of that. But beyond that, it was difficult back then for you to break in.
Yeah, when I wrote the novel, The Unfinished Gift, when I wrote that novel and then made an attempt, I was still a full-time pastor, so I knew I did not have the time to market the book or whatever. I realized if I don't land a very effective agent, this book has no hope of publishing because I didn't have the time to do it. So my goal was to try to find an agent that could do it. But then I found out that, you know, getting a good agent was almost impossible because they're so busy. So it was I was pretty much told, this is not likely to happen. It's just the chances are it's not quite like, you know, struck by lightning or winning the lottery, but not far away from that. And so it was a shock to me, literally a shock to me when I sent it off to these agents and got an instant reply saying, we want to represent you. And then 2 months later, I had this contract with this major publisher. And, you know, the next Christmas, there's my novel in Barnes & Noble and hardback book. So it was shocking, literally, to me. It wasn't like expected at all.
Well, again, I've known Dan Walsh back all the way back into the late 80s. And Dan, I can't tell you how exciting it was for Cindy and me. We were on a trip to Kentucky, and one of your books had come out, and we were wanting to buy it. And again, you know, I know I could probably by then I might have been able to have downloaded it, but I'm one of these old school guys that really still like to buy the book. I like to have the cover in my hand. And although I do have several books on a Kindle app, I don't own a Kindle, but I do have an iPad with a Kindle app. And I just have to say, I'm still to this day not as fond of reading electronically as I am reading a real book. But back to the point, we were in Kentucky and we swung into a bookstore. Actually, at this point, we were in Indiana. We swung into a bookstore in Evansville, Indiana on Green River Road, if anybody knows where that is. And there was one of these major books. I can't remember if it's Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or whatever. But we go into there seeing if your new book, which we were wanting to buy, was available there. And bingo, buddy, there it was. You talk about an exciting day for Cindy and me. That was just like, man, this is so cool. Our friend Dan is everywhere. That was
awesome.
Yeah,
it was like that for us too, because it was – when I had done the research to get the agent, everything I said, it's like you got a 99.9% chance of being rejected. And so when it happened, we were just floored. And we actually were in I don't know where we were. Cindy and I were in, I think it was Denver. And we just out of curiosity went in, you know, the hotel that we were at to down to the grocery store to get some supplies for the hotel, like, you know, drinks and whatnot. And just out of curiosity, I went to the grocery store book section, and shock of shock, there's my book, you know, in this Denver grocery store. So that, I'm not going to lie, that was pretty fun. That was pretty exciting.
You know, when you think about that, Dan, when you see your work like that, that had to cause you to just take a moment and reflect. And I often, like most people, I can relate back to movies and lines from movies in moments like this. But there's a line in the movie that is all about a band, and it is That Thing You Do is the name of the movie.
We just saw that recently after, you know, again, love that movie.
It's a fun movie, and in the movie, at one point, one of the band members turns around and looks at the drummer, and he says this line, "How did we get here?"
Right.
And it's one of my favorite thoughts that we can, at a moment when you're enjoying something and you see the blessing of God, to sit back for you to stand there that day in that grocery store, in the book section of a grocery store, and you see your own book. It had to be one of those, how did I get here moments?
Yeah, it was. And people, you know, back then and that time frame and for the next several years, it's almost hard now to remember, but back then chain bookstores also kind of dominated the scene. Everybody, it was a common thing for my wife and I, almost one of our date day favorite things to do was to go down to Barnes and Noble, spend about 30 minutes browsing and meet up at the cafe to pick, you know, read over books. And I think my very first couple royalty statements back then, ebooks only represented 3%. So, you know, it just shows you, I would never have imagined in that time that just 5 years later, I would be leaving traditional publishing to go with Amazon because ebooks had taken over. I would never have believed if somebody had told me that, but that's how quickly it transitioned.
You know, technology changed everything, not only in your end of the business, but technology's impacted radio as well, television. Technology that is so now at everyone's fingertips. I don't know, you know, you mentioned your folks moving down to be part of the Apollo. One of the most amazing stats that I ever heard would have been probably 15, 20 years ago when somebody made the mention back then talking about the early Palm Pilots and all of the what were called PDA, the personal digital assistant. He and one of the Apollo guys made the comment that there was more technology in our hands in one of these PDAs than what the average NASA engineer had when they landed somebody on the moon.
Yeah, that is crazy.
And I
remember one of my early jobs, I worked at General Electric for a couple of years in a computer room, and it's that old school computer room that you see from the 70s with the raised floor and just, you know, cabinet after cabinet after cabinet with mag tapes and just mm-hmm. And come to find out, like you said, this an average smartphone has way more computing power than that whole room of computers mm-hmm. that I worked in the 70s.
That's right. And the way they had to do their computing even before the mag tapes, there was the punch cards. And all of that had to be done, and it was multiplied by what, who knows what factor of speed to do the computations, to do the crunching of numbers. But now, to see what takes place now, it's both breathtakingly cool and, in my mind at times, just downright scary.
Yeah, I'm with you.
It is on both ends of those spectrums, Dan. And I think that what we're seeing happened in this past couple of weeks in our country, it's leaning toward the latter part of that, the scary part, to think about, wow, life is it's not staying static very long right now. Things are changing, and things are changing as we speak. And while what we could be seeing in the days to come, it might mean more changes. I've got Dan Walsh on the line. Dan is an author, and we're going to hear more about his books that he's written, his latest works, coming up in a moment. But don't go away. This is Afternoons with Mike. I'll be right back. On the line with a dear friend, a guy that I've spent time with, not only professionally, but personally. And Dan, I think about some of the trips we've taken together, even that famous trip that you and I took up north with our wives. What a wonderful time that was to be able to spend that time with your Cindy and my Cindy, our wives both named Cindy. Some of my favorite memories, man, are spent either with you directly or you being in the crowd, all of the conferences that we've been to together. As pastors, there's one thing that you and I share together. I mentioned this to my wife last night. We share a common title as former pastors. And that's something that is a dear part. I'm so grateful. I know that the years you spent in studying theology, the years you spent in serving people, those years shaped you as they did me. And they gave you a position, a perspective, that when it came down to writing, there's no way your writing is not just completely impacted by and shaped from your experiences as a pastor.
Yeah, I would say even from a standpoint of not just the storytelling and clearly my worldview, but there is, you know, in my heart a desire to, and any writer who's writing, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, would know this is true. There's a desire to influence and persuade. Whatever your agenda is, hopefully it's a good one. You know, it's not a greedy one or a, you know, devious one, but that's just normal. That's what, whether it's like, you know, something as silly as like Jurassic Park. You know, Jurassic Park came on the scene, and the year before it came on the scene, I think there was something like 600 students studying paleontology, and Jurassic Park comes on the scene, and then there's like 10,000 wanting to apply in all of these colleges all across the country. It's, you know, art and entertainment have a way of influencing people. And so when I write, obviously, you know, I know that people don't want to read fiction, and they don't want to be preached to in their fiction. So fiction novels that are heavy message don't generally sell well, because people, they have other places to go when they want to be taught and preached to. Fiction has to be great storytelling. So it's been something of a craft to learn how to communicate something that would be effective in communicating, like, say, the light of the gospel in a way it comes across very naturally in a story that people won't be turned off by.
Mm-hmm. How do you approach what you call good storytelling? How does a writer do that? You are one of those people, maybe the most prolific storytellers of authors that I've ever read, because your stories are compelling, interesting. I just got to tell you, I cry all the way through your books. You do that to me, Dan. You make me cry, man. What's up with that?
Well, I mean, I think we gotta make sure, for the sake of people listening, it's a good cry.
It's a good cry. That's right.
It's not like I have a series of dog Forever Home series, and people get tearful, but I always want to put like hashtag right at the beginning, the dog lives, you know? Because people are like, even the title, like Rescuing Finley,
yes,
Finding Riley, Saving Parker, people have said, does the dog live? I said, it's in the title. You know, Rescuing Finley, Finding Riley, Saving Parker, yes, the dog lives.
Yes, it's not tragic. It's not, yeah. There's not an ending.
It's like reading a Christmas Christmas Hallmark card or Christmas Hallmark commercial, maybe, you know, that kind of a cry.
But there's something that's beyond just even the raw emotion in being a good storyteller. You have that ability to mix what is good emotion, what is a kind of like a feel-good story, but you have a way of mixing that with what is a theological basis, and that gets back to your pastoring and your years as a leader in the church. You have that ability to convey and impart theology, and by theology in this way, I mean a right understanding of God and a comforting understanding of God. And I think those are things that are just lost by and large in our culture. In movies, there is such a presence, Dan, of the it's an agenda. It's being called a narrative, and that narrative just does not look anything like what you and I grew up with in good old common stories from the USA or about the USA. It is it's like sand that's shifting under our feet right now. You have that ability. And I believe now we're talking about you being a part of a very select number, a very minor number of writers today who are still doing that, who are writing with a good sense of balance between historically accurate understandings of our nation while having a wonderful view of God. And I just want to say thank you for that.
Well, people have asked me, like, where do your stories come from? And I guess I have to say all good gifts come from above. I mean, because I'm sometimes puzzled myself, because when we've talked about my first novel, The Unfinished Gift, seriously, when I wrote that, I had zero other stories in mind. it was like, this was the book that I could now, you know, die and be a happy man. I wrote a novel. My grandkids will be able to read it. The idea, if you told me you're going to have 23 novels 10 years later, 12 years later, it was been like, I couldn't even imagine having that much to say. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so if even now, like we're talking about my most recent novel that came out at Thanksgiving, it's called The Longest Road. It was a sequel to my third novel. There's like almost 10 years between them, called The Deepest Waters, which was a huge hit.
That was that was one of my favorite books right there.
Yeah, it was my only foray into the 1800s as far as writing in history. I was 18, based on a true story in 1857, and it did really well. But my publisher wanted me from that book forward not to go any further back than World War II. So I didn't get a chance to write a sequel that I had in mind back then. Until very recently, when last year I was able to get almost all of my books back from my publisher because they weren't selling and they weren't marketing them. So by contract, I was able to get those books back and I re-released second editions of them. But it also gave me the freedom now as the publisher of record. I could do things that I wasn't allowed to do then. So mm-hmm. I had always determined to write a sequel to that book. And so that's what I gave myself to do in the second half of last year and published The Longest Road, which was like The Deepest Waters, The Longest Road. It's a follow-up story. And it's doing crazy good. I mean, it's doing amazingly well. There are people who are responding to having read the first book are loving it. And I was obviously concerned when you have a book that says so well, will people hate the sequel? And they don't. They love it. So, but that's getting to what we've been talking about. That was one of the challenges because there's one of the primary characters in that story is this illiterate slave named Micah, mm-hmm. who happens to be the one you could say he is the voice, in a sense, the voice of God in the story. He has the perspective in those scenes where there is a perspective being shared that has the most impacting elements. And that was, you know, it was made easier somewhat because he's such a likable, disarming character that he's not somebody that you're feeling like you're being preached to. He's like sharing perspectives and scenes that are perfectly appropriate considering the scene. But he's also coming from this deep well of a walk with God that he has that really speaks to the moment in the story.
Wow. That is so cool, the way that you can take a character and build into that character not only a personality that is winsome, but also one that conveys something way beyond himself, even becoming, like you said, the presence or the voice of what would be the God aspect of the movie, or the book, rather. And that is something that is such a cool thing. And I guess in my mind, the question I would have from that is, when you are starting to write a book like that one, that has a character like that, set back in the 1800s, when way before we can even comprehend what life would have really been like on a day-to-day basis, I see these images of writers sitting at an old-fashioned typewriter, banging out something, ripping out the paper, wadding it up, throwing it down. What kind of process was it like when you're writing about that particular character? Did you start, stop? What was it like?
Well, I was fortunately, because thankfully it was not an electronic era back then. Real books existed; they're still around. I was able to actually read a number of books written by former slaves, and because quite a few of them that came out through the Underground Railroad wanted to document their story, and quite a few of those are available still. So I was mm-hmm. able to read a lot of these stories, and they're written, you know, written in the thinking and the mindset of the people who lived then. They weren't like edited very much at all. So it was like, you know, somewhat a time capsule, being able to go back and read these things saying, this is how they thought, this is what they believe, this is how they perceive life. So it wasn't as hard as you might think, because I didn't just have to use my imagination. I had the help of the actual resources to draw from.
That kind of research takes time. And so again, I go back and I'm thinking, my goodness, here's a guy that just let us know a while ago that when you wrote your first book, The Unfinished Gift, you did not know of anything beyond that you were going to write. So there had to be some good godly inspiration that started filling your heart and mind with these different ideas? Because your first several books, while they had the similar stamp of your writing style and I believe your ability to tell a story that was so unique, what was different, though, about each and every one of them was the subject matter and the, I guess, the plot. Just getting right down to the basics, you had a diverse amount of themes and ideas that your first several books covered.
Yeah, they had my publisher. This is kind of odd. The first two books, The Unfinished Gift and Homecoming, are a series. And in my mind, I thought that I was going to be continuing to do that. What happened was I started being compared to Nicholas Sparks. And, you know, publishing back then, I'm sure to a certain extent still, was all about marketing and money and what sells.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I wrote the third, because it takes like a year to write a book, back then it did, it wasn't full time. It takes about a year to publish, to write a book and get it to publish back then. So when I wrote those first two books, they hadn't come out yet. The Unfinished Gift had, but I had actually finished The Homecoming before The Unfinished Gift actually hit the shelves. And same thing with The Deepest Waters. I had finished The Deepest Waters before the second book came out. But when the first two books came out, and they both were set during World War II, all these comparisons in the reviews to Nicholas Sparks came out, and my publisher kind of jumped on that, and they said, you know, we want to see if we can't connect you as the Christian Nicholas Sparks, Christian fiction Nicholas Sparks. So we, and at that time, Nicholas Sparks was primarily writing standalones. So they wanted me to stop writing series books and write standalones, which was put a lot more work on me because, you know, you take all this time to invest in character and setting. And now you're basically saying you've got one story to tell and then we're on to another one completely different. But fortunately, by the third book, because things had gone so well, I was able to make the transition to write full time. And you mentioned these things takes time. That's what happened. I was able now, because of the amount of I was writing full time and was no longer pastoring the church, I had the time to do that research and come up with that, you know, challenge. So basically, I'm quite sure if I wasn't full time, there would not have been the time to do that.
You know, when you think about any transition, going from being a full time pastor, now going into this, did you just find those days to be so? I know that transitions themselves can carry a little bit of baggage, and sometimes it's difficult to find your new mooring, your new direction. Did you find yourself just being so busy being cast into this new role that you just didn't have time to think about those other details?
Well, in a way, without going into detail, my transition out of ministry was it was very painful. And abrupt. It wasn't planned the way it happened. If you had to look back on my plan, it was nothing like what happened. And so in some ways, my wife and I look back at the way the Lord opened this door, because it really was that, like that scripture, the Lord makes a river in the desert, a roadway in the wilderness.
Isaiah 43. Yes.
And so for us, when this offer came to write full time for these brand, you know, and doing something I love to do. I mean, it wasn't something I just had to be talked into. I loved doing it. The idea of being able to do it and actually earn my living from it was unimaginable.
Pretty exciting.
Yeah. And God opened that door at precisely the time when we were like, what are we going to do next? And so it was just the kindness and mercy of God to let us fall, so to speak, into that thing. And you're right. Once I got going, it was crazy good therapy, because it allowed me to be completely consumed with this new thing and not dwell on the hurtful things that had happened. Mm-hmm. And it really helped. I'm sure it helped tremendously for us to transition. And it was, I could say safely now, you know, as the years have gone by, it's not even looking back, that pain is not even in my rearview mirror. I don't even hardly connect at all with those emotions. God just opened up a way that allowed us to really refocus and reorient to this new direction. And it was very, I could say, better for us psychologically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. Now we look back on it and just realize, you know, you could kind of that thing almost like with Joseph, what men meant for evil, God meant for good.
Yes, exactly. There was a quote, I wish I had it exactly. I don't. that I read this week from A.W. Tozer. He's one of my favorite writers. And it would be something like, at the end of the day, when the dust settles, we all see that even though we didn't understand it completely or clearly, we will see at the end of the day that God is still very solidly in control. He is the right. sovereign God. And, you know, even in transitions that we all go through at different phases of our life, and there may be aspects like you have described, and I appreciate your honesty and your just the forthrightness. We all know that every transition for every person has some of those things. And it's tough. Sometimes it's just downright tough to make a life change, a life direction change. But I tell you what, Dan, the end result and the fruit of the change in your life has blessed people all over the world. And that's got to be something that blows your mind when I say that, because it's true. One of the things that I'm going to ask, and I know you would never bring this up on your own, but you're decorated with a number of national writing awards. What was it like for you to get the first award like that and for you to realize, you know, I'm being honored for something. I'm being recognized for something that I never would have dreamed would have ever happened. What was that like?
It was crazy. It was freaky. It was ridiculous. I mean, I didn't, again, you have to, you know, I am at this stage of my writing. You know, you're almost like somebody who's, it's almost like kind of like somebody like these, we used to see in American Idol, you know, these people are singing in the shower and maybe singing in the choir. And next thing you know, they're, you know, millions of downloads of their songs, you know, like, okay, and everybody knows who they are. It wasn't quite that dramatic, but it felt that way. Because for me, I would have thought when that first book came out, just that I was able to get published and just that I was able to start to earn a living when I wasn't sure how we were going to earn a living was enough. Then all of a sudden I get nominated for this award, and I'm thinking, as I'm looking at the various people in the category I'm in, I knew I didn't have a chance. So I thought, they always wanted you to prepare a speech. And I thought, okay, well, I guess I'll prepare a speech, but it's ridiculous to think I'll get up and give it. And then I not only won the award, that first award at ACFW, I won the best debut author award for first novel, and that to me was the one I thought I might have a chance. But it also won the book for best historical fiction. In other words, all these veteran writers, the top shelf writers in that category, and I won that category also. And I was like, when they called my name the second time, I almost wanted to faint. So yeah, it was just not expected.
Well, for those of us that have read the books, we're not surprised. Knowing you, I get it. I'm not surprised at all at your response, and I'm glad you didn't faint. I'm glad that you were there, but I was able to read about all of this after the fact and think, yeah, here's my friend. Go, Dan. I love it because your books are warm, your books are fun, and to all of our listeners right now that are listening, that and you, maybe you're not in that place right now where you used to be, where you think, I used to just love to curl up and read a good book. Well, let me tell you, this is a time, if you haven't caught on to it yet, this is a time that I think people need to be curtailing the amount of news, the amount of entertainment via movies. This might be a great time to return to some of those days where it's you, the couch, and a good book. And I would encourage you to consider doing that. And there's nobody I would recommend more than my friend Dan Walsh, who's on the line with me right now. And we're going to be back in a moment with Dan. He's going to tell us about how that this crazy time frame that we're in with COVID, with lockdowns, with changes, with delays in production, all of the things that are going on that are now part of 2021's landscape. We're going to be talking about that in our final segment with Dan Walsh. Don't go away. This is Afternoons with Mike. Back on the line with my dear friend Dan Walsh. Dan is a writer. If you've just tuned in, Dan is an author of a number of books, some of which were done in the kind of the classic publishing way with a publisher, And a number of years ago, that's what I'd like to talk about first of all, Dan, is that transition that every writer like yourself that jumped from being a writer who is represented by a publisher on a major label, if you will, and then all of a sudden now making the transition to becoming what in the industry is known as an indie writer, one that self-publishes. That had to be a scary move in and of itself.
Yeah, it was. It happened in 2014. That was probably the year I woke up to the reality that I couldn't safely stay with my publisher. Things were changing rapidly, and Amazon was just ascending in such a speed, and the Kindle app became available, and smartphones were now available. And my 5 years earlier, where my ebooks were 3%, they were over 50%. And the problem was, in the traditional contract situation, the authors have very little control over anything other than you write the book. But once it leaves your hands, you have very little control over the marketing, the pricing, and it winds up being a case where, and that's why so few authors are able to write full time. You have to sell something of the range of 25 to 50,000 copies to generate enough, because the amount of money the publishers pay you is so small. You have to sell that many books for your cut of the income to be enough to live on. Mm-hmm. So fortunately, I was selling that many books, but that's because they're all in these stores. Well, now all these readers are buying Kindles, and they're all buying ebooks, and they're all going to Amazon, and the book sales in the stores were dwindling. So you could just see the writing on the wall, and my wife and I prayed about it. And my contract that I were with my publisher was coming due 2015, and they were asking me, what do you want to write next? So I submitted two different ideas to them for books, both of which they turned down, saying, what else do you have? And they had never done that before. They had everything I sent them, they were like jumping at it. And so I thought, okay, I really believe in these books. One was the Rescue Dog series, and the other was a suspense novel that I wanted to write. So my wife and I just kind of saw that, okay, Lord, maybe that's just you pushing me out of the nest, because I've been praying about whether we should. So I thanked them and decided, after praying quite a bit about it, that we're just going to make the leap. And so 2015, I released the suspense novel it was kind of like, I had written a couple of novels that were as suspenseful, but they're marketed as the Nicholas Sparks style. And this was more like pure suspense. The One Night Comes, there's a new series, this Jack Turner series that I was exploring. And so I wrote that. And then I also wrote the first book called Rescuing Finley of the dog series that they rejected.
Which is a marvelous story.
Yeah, it's turned out to be that book that they rejected, that series I rejected, has sold way more books than any of my Revell books ever had.
That's awesome.
And so the series that they rejected that they didn't think would sell well has become my best-selling series. And I'm actually writing now the fourth book to that series called Keeping Bailey will be my next book. We have a fourth book in that series that will hopefully release in May. But so I spent basically that 2015 through the present basically saying, okay, well, we're on our own now, and we're with Amazon. The good news, Amazon, even though sadly there's something of a big monster now with the big tech, from a standpoint of how they treated writers, it was way, way better. I mean, they were willing to pay you 70% of the sale of the book, whereas I was getting something closer to 10% of retail before. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to sell as many books to make up the gap. And we were able to survive that first year. And then from that, the income grew as I was able to release more and more books. And then last year, like I said, got all the books back from the publisher that I was able to re-release under my own label. So now I have, of the 23 novels I have out, all but five of them I have under my publishing imprint. And so, we're just doing way, way better than we ever were.
Now, the five books that are not under your purview then, what would be the reasons for those? Is that just reasons?
Four of them are the series I did with Gary Smalley, the late Gary Smalley.
Oh, okay, yes.
And they're all wrapped up legally with his estate and Revell. And I don't know that I may never get those books back. And the other one was a book I wrote for Guidepost that was part of a series that, again, it was known at the beginning that I would never get the rights back. This is owned by Guidepost. At the time, it provided nice income for us when we needed it. But so basically I'm looking at the books that I have now, and from, and going forward will be books that I have a great deal of say and control over how they are marketed and how they're written.
Well, that's a wonderful thing that you are now in the control of all of those marvelous early novels that really, I think, opened the door for you as a writer. And when I think about somebody that started off this thing with a novel in their heart, in their mind, doing it part-time, and kind of like thinking it would, maybe if I can do this, then I'm done. And you did it and you weren't done. In fact, that opened the door to you becoming a full-time writer. Dan, what has this day and age that all of us are waking up every day and we're wondering, well, what changes am I going to find today? What things are happening today? And sadly, my chuckling right now, it's ironic chuckling. It's not that I'm happy about anything that is going on. It's a sad and yet sobering time. And were it not for, as believers of our trust in God, these are times that could be just downright disheartening and scary. With all that's going on from COVID, 2020 we thought was going to be the end of it all, and 2021 looks like it could be year of COVID number two, and then all these other changes that are happening in our country, the unfortunate events last week. How do these things impact a writer like yourself who is making their living writing stories? How has this impacted you?
Well, on one level, very little. By that, I mean, people still love to read stories. And you pointed out, so many more people are home than would prefer to be working, or they're working from home. So it doesn't seem like it, in the way, in terms of the crisis that everyone's facing, is greatly affecting people's desire to read. And let's face it, you can buy my books on Kindle for $3.99 for less than a cup of coffee. So we're not talking about major expense. You know, people can still, and thankfully in that regard, my book sales last year were not less than the year before. And the way they're starting up for 2021, I don't see any drop. So
thank God for that.
Yeah. And that's, and in some ways, and from a COVID standpoint, I was already working at home. Writers write from home, so I didn't have to change my location for work. But I am, from like as most people, very connected to so many people who are affected, and it's greatly affecting me on an emotional standpoint. But like you said, the more radical things that are happening in the political thing, the overall effect it's had on me probably brings me back to the rock of my faith, which is, Jesus said that my kingdom is not of this world. I think we as believers can sometimes inadvertently make a shift that we didn't plan on, where we're looking to political agencies for a level of help that they cannot provide.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is, when everything is shaken, if that's where your trust is, you're going to be shaken right along with it. And I think there's some of that going on, but a lot, I think believers who have established their faith in the vine versus the branches are drawing from the vine more than ever now, because they realize, really, even as bad as it's gotten in terms of losing the various political races and whatnot, I reflect back on what life is like for the believers in the time of Paul and Peter and James and John.
Mm-hmm.
We still have it way better than them. And politically, and the government that was controlling them was far more oppressive. These are trials, and they are real, and they're serious, but I'm trying to draw my strength, probably the same place you are, and that's from the Lord, and really try to, I can't wait for this COVID thing to pass, to where church can become much more of a lively aspect of my life because of all the social distancing and masks and all of that. But from a standpoint of my overall outlook, I think we really do need to continue to, as believers, really allow the Holy Spirit to make up the gaps, to let the strength of, the joy of the Lord become our strength, and not be overly focused on political solutions. Because let's face it, they're in short supply these days.
They are indeed, Dan, and that is exactly what I'm doing, and we've got less than a couple of minutes left. In my reading with my wife recently, the thing that you said, your dependence upon the Lord in times like these, we read something from Paul David Tripp that was just wonderful, and he talked about how many people look horizontally for the help that they need, which only comes from our vertical help, which is from the Lord. And so we cannot look to men, we cannot look to systems, we can't look to government to give us what only God is intended to give us. And it only comes from Him, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. Dan, give us how people can find your books. What would be the simplest way for them to find you? I'm for finding a new book from Dan Walsh or one of your older books.
If they just go on Amazon and type in the search box, Dan Walsh Books. And, or Dan Walsh author page or whatever, all my books will be gathered together in a fairly short place. And you could look at the, you know, click on the cover. You could just read the, you know, there's, like I said, there's 23 of them on there to choose. And of those, I think 18 of them are ones that I'm in control over. I still think the other books are doing fine, but they're easy to find. Just go to Amazon, say Dan Walsh Books or Dan Walsh Author. And Amazon will gather them all up, and you can read through and pick the books that look interesting. You read some reviews, you know, make your choices. Thankfully, my reviews are basically been amazing. I mean, several of my books have over 1,000 reviews, mostly 5 stars. So there's quite a lot of reviews to read.
Well, I tell you what, as a personal testimonial, read them all, but also make sure you read number 1 and number 2, The Unfinished Gift and Homecoming.
Those are a good place to start. Yep.
Those are books that I think are must reads. And Dan, you're just one of my favorite people. Thank you so much for being with me today.
I've really enjoyed it, Mike. Look forward to the next time.
There will be another time. And Dan, God bless you. And friends, thank you for being with me today on Afternoons with Mike. We'll catch you next time right here on The Shepherd.